Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities with Lori Peterson and Abby Weinstein. Lori and Abby spend their days talking about dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. They talk to parents of struggling students and adults who have had a lifetime of academic challenges. They want to share those stories along with their own insights with you. So, let's talk learning disabilities.
Welcome to Let's Talk Learning Disabilities. This is Abby.
And this is Lori.
And we are here today for episode number 44. And we're so happy to have you here.
It's crazy that we're on 44. And we say this every week because we still can't believe, honestly, for two ADHD people, the fact that we've stuck with it for 44 episodes.
It's huge.
I mean, like, high fives to us, right?
I agree. We've stuck with it. It's been over a year that we've been recording these episodes.
Just because we love doing it.
And we do love doing it. And we love getting great feedback. In fact, you know, we have people call in to our office asking, can I speak to Lori or Abby? Or we'll answer the phone and say, Diagnostic Learning Services, this is Abby. Oh, is this Abby from the podcast or is this Lori? And so it's very exciting that we have great listeners, that we're reaching many, many listeners all over the world, and that we have become a resource
Absolutely.
For parents.
Well, and I feel like, too, this is information I've always wanted to be able to share, but I'm terrible at writing. And I always tell, you know, we always joke when I'm going over results with parents for our ADHD kiddos that, you know, the writing process is such a challenge. And I'm always thinking, can't I just tell you what I want to say? Do I have to write it down?
Mm-hmm.
So this has been so great for me to be able to just tell you
just
what I want to say.
Out.
So anyway, enough about us.
So today we have a very special guest joining us. We've got Amy Whipple, and Amy is a speech language pathologist, or an SLP for short, as well as an advocate. And we brought her in today to talk a lot about speech and language and communication disorders, speech and language impairments, or speech and language disorders. That's an area that we really haven't touched on a lot. So hopefully this will be informative and interesting for you all, or a good resource. So hi, Amy. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Abby. Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about you and your history as a speech language pathologist, kind of how you came to be able to do that and why.
Okay. I'm going to start in the beginning, because when I was 3 years old, I started working with a speech language pathologist. Yeah. I had articulation errors, and I also spoke very quickly. So my parents brought me once a week to my local school, and I remember skipping down the hallway, so excited to work with my teacher named Mr. Sikorsky.
I remember that.
I know. Oh, that's amazing.
Well, he had a big impact on my life. And I was about to turn 4, and my parents were starting to think ahead to kindergarten. Now, this was the late 70s, and back then, you would start school by the age of 4 or 5. And the cutoff was December 31st, and I had a late October birthday. And so they asked him, they said, what do we do with Amy? Like, is she ready? And he said, Amy has a lot of thoughts in her head, and she can't get them out fast enough, but she's more than ready for kindergarten. And it truly changed the whole trajectory of my life.
Wow.
And it always was kind of like a family story that my parents will still bring up now and then, because he had such a big impact on my life and theirs. Mm. And then when I was in college, my grandmother had a stroke, and I remember speaking to her on the phone, and she could hardly talk at that point. And then I flew down to Florida with my mom, and I was amazed within like a week or two that she had essentially recovered her language skills. It's called spontaneous recovery. But she literally was like a different person 2 weeks later. And wow. I remember speaking with the SLP saying, how did this happen? And she kind of filled me in. And I really decided, okay, I think this could be the field for me. I love education in schools. And I also like the medical aspect. I love neuroanatomy and all that kind of fun stuff. So here I am now. I've been licensed for over 22 years. So
that's great.
That's a great story.
That is a great story. So, and I just want to make sure that everyone understands. So you said that you had articulation errors.
Yes.
So just explain briefly what that means when you say articulation errors, because there's so many different kinds of speech and language impairments.
Yep.
So what is an articulation disorder
or
error?
You know, when people think of speech therapy or a speech therapist, they only think of articulation. And for me, that's what my issue was. I would diagnose when I look back at myself. I mean, my parents have no paperwork from back then, but I would guess that I had a pure artic disorder because I only had trouble producing a couple sounds and it did not impact my reading at all. I mean, I've always been a voracious reader, but I also had an expressive language disorder because I spoke so quickly. And it was like, I mean, I look back at myself now and I'm like, would I have been diagnosed as well with ADHD? Because, mm-hmm. you know, my grandmother would say, Amy, you have ants in your pants. I was dancing. I was running around. I was all over the place. But it kind of all settled down for me. I want to say by like first grade and second grade, the artic was gone. And I learned how to slow down my speech. And I still actually, in my mind, I'll kind of mentally rehearse, you know, when I'm speaking at an IEP meeting or I'm running a workshop. So it's something that I still, in my mind, will have to kind of slow myself down.
Mm. So can we talk a little bit about the articulation disorders? So I have a son who had some articulation issues. We worked with a speech therapist. And for him, we did a little bit of time when he was about four. But then we had to take a break because developmentally, we had kind of tapped out or topped off, you know, his skill level. But we went back again when he was six or seven. So can you talk kind of about articulation and the developmental process of how you form sounds?
Yeah. So if you look at, and I just want to give a resource right now for any parents that are listening, ASHA.org, they have on their website, the developmental norms for speech sounds. And so there's certain sounds that you acquire first. You know, people often say like when a little baby, when they're 1 year old, oh, they said, you know, mama or bubba for bottle. Well, because those are earlier development, you know, earlier developing sounds. Sure. And so over time, there's certain sounds such as TH and R's that are later developing sounds. So perhaps the SLP that was working with your son said, okay, right now he's mastered these ones. I'm going to wait a little bit to work on those other later developing sounds.
See if they develop on their own.
Mm. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Or his brain isn't developmentally ready to produce those sounds.
That could be that. I mean, I had trouble with R's and I had trouble, I want to say maybe with some blends of words together, like clusters, but R's were my most difficult sound and R's can be notoriously difficult to treat. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some SLPs that they basically have a whole Instagram page on like, you know, there's speech therapy for R's, but usually it is a later developing sound. And for many kids, it will eventually, you know, develop. Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question though, but if you miss that window, right? And say you've got like a 12-year-old who still can't say their R's, you as a therapist though, you can help that student, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot harder. You know, we call it almost like bad habits because there's placement. Where are you producing the sound, the manner, you know, where R's are really difficult to treat. And same with some of the S's as well. Like for example, what a lot of like the general public knows about is like the word lisp. They know if a person lisps because it's a lateral S, meaning that the way they're producing the sound is different than how it should be produced. So it can be a lot harder the longer you wait. So if, you know, you're concerned about your child, I mean, I'm such a big advocate for the earlier the treatment, the better. Absolutely. But it's hard now to get those speech-only services in the schools. I mean, when I worked in the two large urban districts, I mean, I would be like, oh my gosh, I've got kids who can't even formulate sentences. And, you know, you have one kid who has like some R sounds. It doesn't seem, you know, it just depends on, right. Yeah, what else right. is going on.
That makes sense.
So when we're talking about, so you said you went for articulation errors, struggling to make certain sounds. And I think you're right. That is the most common speech impairment that people think about or the reason why they think children need to go for speech therapy. Yep. But there are other types of speech and language impairments or communication disorders. So will you tell us a little bit about some of the other communication disorders that are common that could benefit from speech therapy?
Absolutely. So SLPs, I'm just going to use that acronym because speech language pathologist is a long term. Mm-hmm. They wear many, many hats. And if you go on like the ASHA.org website, you would be amazed all the different areas they work on. I'm just going to focus on school-age children from like preschool through high school. So number one is speech. But within that speech or articulation, there's actually phonology. And as we know, phonology or phonological processing skills, that really affects reading. Mm-hmm. Those are students who have difficulty perceiving the differences in sounds. So for example, with me, I didn't have trouble differentiating between W's and R's. I could hear the difference. I learned to read. But for other kids who have phonological processing disorders, that might be difficult for them to perceive differences.
So is that then more of how they process, how they hear it? Is it more of an auditory processing issue?
Yeah. And that's a really good, yeah, something like that. Exactly. They perceive it differently.
Okay.
So an SLP really has to determine, okay, is it pure articulation or is it a phonological disorder?
That's very mm-hmm. interesting. You're exactly yeah, right.
And though. It absolutely impacts reading. And that is like, so when I was in graduate school, that was one of the key things we learned. And back then it was still, everybody was calling it artic therapy. No, it's more than that. And so you really have to have a really highly trained individual who understands that relationship, because spoken language or oral language is the foundation for written language.
Absolutely.
You can't learn to read and write without strong, you know, comprehension skills and oral expression skills. So mm-hmm. they all, you know, they go together.
Absolutely.
Right.
And that's the one area under speech. And then there's also motor planning issues. Some children who have apraxia, childhood apraxia of speech. So that would also kind of be under that speech realm.
Can you explain what apraxia is? We get calls about that a lot, mm-hmm. actually.
Yeah, that's a motor planning. And there's a lot of inconsistencies with it as well. So maybe one day the child's able to produce the sound, the next day they can't. It can be a real struggle, like severe difficulty producing sounds.
What do you mean by motor planning?
The brain to the oral motor structure being
able. So how do you differentiate that from just an articulation issue?
So usually, you know, it's based on the evaluation process. You have to evaluate to determine. Usually it's a lot more errors overall. It's persistent errors. It can be inconsistent as well. So the child can be very difficult to understand. There can be multiple phonological processes that are affected. I mean, I had probably a handful of students when I worked in the public schools. I mean, it's not super common. But it's,
is it something that you grow out of, or is it something that affects you lifelong?
Yeah, you have to get the speech
therapy. Okay.
Yeah, from a trained. I mean, there's some SLPs that are highly trained in that area. They have programs as well that they use. And off the top of my head, I forget the name of the program, but I had one of my students who I had to use like a specific research-based program. It wasn't a matter of, oh, here's some flashcards. Let's practice these words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not right. like that at all.
Interesting. Okay.
And then also with that, when you evaluate, don't you, I might be ill-informed, but I think you also are looking at their mouth and their tongue placement and their ability to be able to physically correctly form the yep. sounds and the motor skills within their mouth, the oral motor skills to produce the sounds. So I think it's important too for parents to know that you might, you know, if you're missing a bunch of teeth in your mouth, that's going to impact your articulation and the way you speak, or if they have a tongue thrust or they're pushing their tongue forward. So they also might have to go to a dentist and get their mouth looked at, right?
Oh, yeah. You need to do an oral mech. They call it an oral mech exam, where you examine the child's mouth. Every speech and language evaluation should have an oral mech exam, where you're looking at, okay, can they move their tongue back and forth? You know, do they have what they call a tongue tie? Do they not have enough movement with their tongue? You know, you have to do something like that. But again, I have to say, in almost every student that I evaluated, and I don't even know what the number was, but it was I worked in the schools for over 13 years. Very rarely did I find something wrong.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, and usually if a child had like feeding issues when they were younger, you know, maybe a child had difficulty breastfeeding or taking a bottle, and, you know, children, some, you know, I don't necessarily can say what the cause is, but very few students that I did oral mech exam on, was there something very noticeable going on?
Mm, that's good to know.
That is good to know. Yeah. You rule it out, but it's good to know.
So then let's talk about the L in the speech language. Let's talk about the language side of things, because I think that's probably where, that's definitely, we see both, but the language piece, I think, is the most misunderstood part of what you
do. I would agree.
Yeah, it's a huge category. So language, it's language comprehension or receptive language, or language oral language, such as expressive language. And so it impacts a child throughout the whole entire school day. So for comprehension, can they understand stories? Can they follow directions? Can they understand questions? Can they learn new vocabulary words? Can they answer questions? Can they follow along with an assignment that's being given in class? I mean, it's language is everything. School. Mm-hmm. School is language. Right. And then oral expression is being able to formulate grammatically correct sentences, being able to retrieve words and use them appropriately, speaking in conversations, asking questions, making commands. So yeah, it impacts the whole entire day. And I would say almost all of my students that I had in my caseload had issues with one or the other.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when we talk to parents and we suspect a language disorder, whether it be expressive or receptive, you know, we always explain to them the very first thing, you know, yes, we're seeing issues with reading and writing and but let's start with the language therapy, because a lot of what you do in language therapy is going to be teaching them those comprehension skills that then they can apply to their reading. But if they don't even understand it in conversation, that's where we have to start, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And it always surprises me when a student would come up in like third or fourth grade. I'm like, how did they make it this far? But, you know, they often say, and this kind of extends to the reading and writing as well, you know, up to third grade, the old line was you're learning to read. Now you're reading to learn. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times those kids, that's when they pop up with the reading comprehension issues, but they oftentimes have underlying comprehension issues.
Right.
And then the writing is another whole ball. I mean, with writing, you have to use, you know, executive functioning skills. You have to have sustained attention. You have to be able to formulate your thoughts in a formal manner. You know, it's not just writing the way you talk. Right. And so I see so many students who are actually fine through like third or fourth grade, and then boom, they hit a wall with the writing. So yeah, they're interlocked, you know, they go together. And again, I would find it really difficult to see a child on a speech and language caseload and they have no problems with reading or writing. Like, it doesn't even make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have, it's almost like there's no way it wouldn't impact your reading or your writing.
Right.
It would be impossible.
I think that's so important for everyone to realize, is that that's why it's so important to address language difficulties or language issues, because it impacts all aspects of learning and even your social relationships and working in cooperative groups and developing friendships. And
well, that's another huge part of our, one of the many hats we wear is working on pragmatic skills and social skills. So that's being able to understand nonverbal and verbal cues, being able to participate in conversations, the ability to make friends and sustain those friendships, knowing how to react. Like, let's take, this is recently I had a case, a fifth grader, he shows up to school late one day, he walks into his room, all the kids are sitting down, quietly taking a test. He looks, he yells, "What is everyone doing?" Can't read the social cues.
Right.
And that's something that I always worked on. I mean, I had a lot of students who did have the social emotional disorders, and I would do social stories with them and we would make them up. So for example, some kids have a hard time at recess or at lunch. So oftentimes those unstructured parts of their school day, but then you just see it, you know, outside of school too. They're on a sports team. They have no friends. Or, you know, they go to the playground. They don't know how to interact. I would start every single session with my students, "Good morning." And they'd look at me like, what is she saying? Right. Like, "Good morning, Johnny." And I'd be like, "Good morning, Mrs. Whipple." And like, I would just work on, yeah, you greet somebody. You ask them how their weekend was. You know, "What'd you do this weekend?" "Nothing." And so I would like joke and they thought it was funny. "You sat in a chair and you did nothing?" "No, I watched the Patriots game." And I'm like, "Okay, wasn't that a great touchdown by Tom Brady?" And then they'd be like, "Yeah." And they start to get the idea of how that language is social reciprocity, that you should share and you ask questions of others. It's a huge part of SLP's caseloads. Huge part.
So If you were going to give some advice to parents of young kids, you know, on how to best develop language, obviously there are disorders and impairments that get in the way. But if you were going to, you know, give some advice on how best to develop language to avoid some of these things, what do you recommend?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that it's not your fault. A lot of parents come in and they feel really guilty. And yes, there can be a genetic component. As we know, there is sometimes a genetic component. The most common one is developmental language disorder. That's the new term, DLD. It's more encompassing. It's an umbrella term. Before it was specific language impairment, and now there's developmental language disorder. And sometimes it runs in families, sometimes it doesn't. But you can't blame yourself. Honestly, it's just reading stories before you go to bed, cooking, talking about what you're doing, modeling language. Okay, I'm cutting up the fruit now. Can you pass me the apple? Can you pass me the strawberry? You know, I think sometimes parents don't realize how much kids just pick up from that like incidental language that they hear around them. Because sometimes parents will think, oh, I need to buy a new fancy app for the iPad or for the phone. No, right. No. It's just literally getting on the floor next to your kid. They're playing with a farmhouse. Because I remember I worked with preschoolers for a long time. Play. Just play with your kids. Model language. Expand on what they're saying. If they say a cow, say, oh, look it. The cow has black and white, you know, spots on them. Right there, you're expanding their sentence. Or the pig. Oh, the pig is rolling in the mud. You just model language whenever you can. When you're driving in the car. Like, oh, let's see how many different kinds of flowers outside our window. I mean, it's a lot. I think parents, a lot of times they think it has to be some, you know, fancy type of therapy, but at least when you're working with younger kids, a lot of it's play. Because play is very closely linked with cognition. Mm-hmm. So when you have strong play skills, you know, you work on your cognition skills too.
And don't you feel like technology now has taken away a lot of those conversations because everybody's on a device and you're not having those, or you're texting in short little blurbs and you're not using your words.
Absolutely. Okay. And you know what? I want to say too, parents, sit on the bed, read a story. And it doesn't have to be a long story. It could be their favorite board book. And you might be bored of that board book, but just read it over and over again. Then have the child read it back to you. Ask simple questions. It doesn't have to even be anything fancy. And then it gets them interested, like, oh, let's go to the library. Mm-hmm. Let's check out another book. And they might choose the same one over and over again. That's okay. Let them do the reading then. So you work on the narrative skills in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. So when we're testing older students, whenever we start going over the cognitive part of the evaluation, you know, the verbal skills are always first. Yep. And anytime I have somebody with either really high or really low, my question immediately is either, I bet you read for pleasure or I bet you don't. Because those kids, as you get older, past, I don't know what age it is, you might know, you stop learning vocabulary from your surroundings. You really need those books to help you increase your vocabulary. So I have older kids who, even if they have ADHD, whatever, if they love to read, their verbal skills are off the charts.
Yeah.
If they hate reading and they're in high school, college, their verbal skills are usually low average.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen to audiobooks. I do want to say that, you know, sometimes people say, oh, that's not reading. Well, if I know a lot of people, adults included, they prefer audiobooks over actually reading. You learn, just think about it, you're learning still. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not working on your actual reading or decoding skills,
but
you are learning more vocabulary. And like you said, kids, I mean, they've done studies on like babies and toddlers. Kids hear it through when you're pregnant. They can hear when you talk to the baby. I mean, they hear words around them. So if you start reading at a very early age, there, and then if you even move on, say, hey, why don't you download, you know, you like the Harry Potter series, just download that, anything to get them, or even the graphic novels. I know a lot of like middle school and high schoolers that have trouble with the reading. A lot of times teachers will say, oh, well, it's not really a book. Yes, it is.
That is.
Whatever they're interested in. Like I say to my boys, you know, well, still, like I'll be like, okay, order yourself an actual book. I don't care what you order. I don't care what you order, just order what you're interested in. Because you know what the problem is too, there's a lot of assigned reading as well. It kind of turns the kids off. And like my middle schooler was like, you know, they get their summer reading lesson. It's like, oh, I don't want to read this.
Right.
And I'll say, you know what? Make sure to choose something that you do like. Because again, it will just really just improve your vocabulary as well.
And get the audio.
Get the audio.
Absolutely,
right.
Get the audio.
That is great advice, I think. And also, I think it's important to know if parents do suspect that their child has a language difficulty or a speech difficulty, how can they go about being evaluated and, you know, how do they qualify for speech therapy in the school setting? Or like you started when you were 3 years old or 4 years old, what would you recommend parents do if they suspect a speech or language problem with their child?
So they have a couple options. Sometimes if a student's getting, well, they're a child at that point, they're getting early intervention services. Early intervention will set up an evaluation with the school, because once you turn three, you can get services from your local school district. Sometimes that's how services begin in the schools. Other times, maybe a pediatrician refers the family to the school. Other times it's the parent. They can write a letter. You don't need permission to do it. Write a letter and request an evaluation. And once the school receives your request or your consent, you have to sign for it. Then they can, you know, start the process of evaluating your child, writing the report, and then holding the IEP or the eligibility meeting to see if
you're trying. If I have a 3 or 4 year old, I would just contact my local my neighborhood elementary school.
Yes. Yes. Oh, and what they'll do is usually the special ed department in your district or the special ed coordinator, they'll set it up for you. Sometimes what the schools will do, they'll say, oh, we have a screening next month. You don't have to wait for that screening if you're that concerned. Now, listen, if you're kind of on the fence about it and, you know, you're not that worried, sure, you can wait for the screening because, you know, chances are they'd have the SLP, the occupational therapist, maybe even a teacher there. But for the most part, if you have concerns, schedule that evaluation because it can take. In Massachusetts, it's 45 school days. But same, I know in states like California, it's 60 days. Wow. And if you think about all the school vacations and holidays and days off.
At the semester.
Yes. Yes. And it's very frustrating. And I always, you know, it's funny. I always post to parents. I'm like, okay, we're reaching that 45 school day mark, like in March, late March, early April, like get those consents in now because otherwise you're going to have to wait.
Right.
And I think it's also really quick to remind everybody that speech and language services in the public schools falls under that special education umbrella. So you're going through the special education process. It's one of those services that's provided there. So it is all taken care of under, you know, through that department under that umbrella. So sometimes that can be confusing too.
Right.
Yeah, there's 13 disability categories. So sometimes a child might qualify under specific learning disability, sometimes under communication, sometimes if a child has a hearing impairment, under that. Yeah, right. I mean, I've seen it under sometimes even other health. Mm-hmm. If, let's say, for example, they have cerebral palsy or they have Down syndrome. So it just depends. It depends.
Or ADHD.
And then you can also then just go to a private therapist. There are a lot of SLPs that work in private practice.
Right.
That does not require really anybody's approval. It's like you just want to go get it checked out and you can, and they will work on whatever the weak areas are. There's not a qualification like under special education. There are certain scores and things that have to line up for you to get services. If you have a concern, you can get a private therapist to work with them. Some insurances will cover it. Some don't. It's something that you check with your insurance about. But that is can be a really effective way too, especially if you want it to happen faster than
waiting
for 45 to 60 school days.
Right. Absolutely. Most of the parents I know will do that if their child doesn't qualify or if they just think their child needs an extra, you know, session a week. I mean, sometimes they say to me, because I mean, I know I worked in the schools, I'd have small groups. Very rarely did I see students individually. Every now and then, for example, the student that had childhood apraxia of speech, I saw him individually twice a week. And he also worked with a private SLP. And he was doing really, really well because the more treatment he got, the better he did. But, you know, for some kids, those small groups are good. You know, that's all they need. Sometimes with like the social skills as well, I mean, it's probably better to work in a group with other students because when you're just working with a teacher, a lot of times those kids who might have some social communication disorders, they can do very well with adults, but they have a harder time with their peers and classmates. So it's really important to have that opportunity. Sometimes even the guidance counselor or, you know, other teachers will work with that child on that as well. So, you know, you really have to take that team approach. You know, I always say to parents, when I worked in schools, they're with me for an hour a week. You're with them all the time.
Right.
So what you do is more important. Like, I would give them information I was working on.
I will guide you.
But what you do at home is so important. And yeah. Same with the teachers in the classroom. Like, you know, some of the best teachers that I worked with, their classrooms were set up like language-based classrooms, although they weren't technically a language-based classroom. But right. They knew they had to have lots of visuals. They had to have clear, you know, structure. They were, you know, it was a very organized setup for students. And you would just see these kids take off in those types of classrooms.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So you are no longer working in the schools as an SLP.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Okay. So after I had my third son, I was looking for a little bit of a change. And I, you know what? I meant to shout them out. They're 16, 14, and 10. And
wow.
Yeah. So after my third son, I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to stay and deal with the commute. So I worked very briefly for a contractor agency who put me at a school system. And that's where I became interested in special education advocacy, because I saw a student who was not appropriately placed. And it completely changed my life. And I decided to go through the training through the Federation for Children with Special Needs. I did training through Rights Law. And I opened up my business 9 years ago this month. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was funny because at the time, my supervisor, who had been my supervisor when I was like a graduate student, said, don't ever give up your certification in speech. And I said, I won't. I promise. Because I love the field. It's not that I, you know, right. wanted to change mm-hmm. professions, but I kind of wanted to use it in a different way. And yeah, I've been doing it now for 9 years.
And so you tell me, so you help parents that just need help navigating the special education world.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, they all contact me at different times. Some parents contact me when the school is, you know, rejected, saying, okay, no, your child's not eligible for services. Sometimes a parent will, you know, contact me if they're having a really difficult relationship with the school. That's the one thing I really pride myself on. You know, I've sat on every side of the table. I've been a school-based SLP. I'm a mom of three boys. I'm a special ed advocate. So I really understand other people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you see advocates, you know, they've got a pitchfork in their hands and mm-hmm. no, that's not my style and it never will be. You know, I really want to collaborate and work with the schools. And you know what too? The schools do have resources. Sometimes I think people can't think outside the box. You know, they get kind of stuck with, oh, this is the only classroom we can offer. Right. Okay, well, how about the child goes there for reading and then is integrated in regular general ed for the other half of the day? You know, sometimes they just need to hear other mm-hmm. types of, you know, options. Yeah, yeah.
So if a parent has a question about the special education process, whether it be during the evaluation process, after the evaluation, having to do with eligibility, services, placement, any of those, you can help answer those questions. And you can also help them navigate the IEP or the Individualized yes. Education Plan development and implementation process, which can yes. be very
overwhelming,
sitting in those IEP meetings and looking at a 30-page document about your child and not being able to understand half of it.
It's like reading a foreign language. It's a legal document.
And
if you're not familiar with the language, that's what I teach about now, because despite having so many different clients and their children had so many different diagnoses, they always ask me the same types of questions mm-hmm. because it's confusing and it's overwhelming. I mean, I have parents that will say to me, I dread this meeting more than any other thing. I'd rather, you know, no offense to the dentist, I'd rather go to the dentist and get a root canal done mm-hmm. than go to the IEP meeting. And I try to take away kind of that worry from the process. So I teach a course called the IEP Workshop, where I go through all of my like best tried and true like strategies, but I go through every single section of the IEP.
Oh, that's awesome.
That is awesome.
So, and I mean, and I try to make it interesting too. I'm not going to put, you know, like, I'm like, I get it. You know, sometimes the schools will hold them and like the parents will tell me, they're like, that was awful. Like, it's very dry because they're not boring. Going to help. They will give you the basics mm-hmm. and they will tell you what your rights are. But they're not going to tell you, hey, get that private evaluation done. Or, right. hey, write your parent concern section before you go to the meeting. They're not going to give you those types of tips. So
that IEP workshop that you have, do you have to be in Massachusetts to come to your workshop to access that?
No, I teach it live via Zoom. This has been probably the best result of the pandemic. I hold it via Zoom. So anybody from any state can attend the IEP workshop.
Is that information on your website?
Yes, it is. And it's also, I have to update it because the last one I held was last month. Okay. And I'm not going to hold another one because the summer's here until early September. But in September, I'll have another one. And it's 3 hours. So you get it, you go through it, you learn a lot, you get all my resources. I also provide templates too, just for letters to write to the school. What I did is I kind of took 22 years of special ed experience. What is the most important things that the parents need before they attend the next meeting? And I'll have parents tell me, they'll say, Amy, it's taken me 5 years to even like understand what to ask for. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it can feel too late.
Right.
So that was one of the reasons why. And I actually, believe it or not, enjoy attending IEP meetings because it's the one time you get every single individual there. And I love hearing the different perspectives because everybody has a different take on your child. And mm-hmm. a lot of times parents will be like, it's me and my partner and like 8 other people. And I said, but if you go unprepared, you know what? You're going to feel a lot better about it versus. Yeah,
absolutely. You feel like you're a more integral part of the team, right? You're not just there for them to tell you what to do. You're going to participate.
You're and parents forget that you are part of the IEP team.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they don't even believe me sometimes when I tell them that.
Yeah,
and
I'll say,
that's why
you want your voice heard.
Exactly.
And it matters. Your voice matters. It's an important part of that team.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting because I noticed like when the pandemic started and the kids went back to school last year, the schools were really listening to the parents because guess what? The kids were at home. They were remote learning, hybrid learning. They knew what their child's functioning was like. Mm-hmm. Now I'm seeing it kind of go back in the other way again because kids were back in school.
Right.
Schools are being a little bit stricter now, like where before it was if a parent contacted the school, oh, we'll provide services. Now it's like, well, they don't qualify. So that's been an interesting thing I've noticed in the last year.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, we will put your website in our show notes so that parents can access that. I think those IEP workshops sound amazing.
Amazing.
Thank you for sharing all of your speech and language knowledge. This has been awesome because I do feel like it's not something we've touched on. And I feel like we could probably talk about it for another hour.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it is such an integral part
of my voice held out, I'd be here all day. Yeah.
It definitely. And I think it's just so important how you talked about that it impacts all aspects of learning and a child's school day. So it is an important topic. I'm glad we touched on it. So thank you so much for all your knowledge and expertise and experience and for your time for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, we will put your information in the show notes. If you guys have any questions or have any suggestions about future topics, don't hesitate to email us at letstalklearningdisabilities@gmail.com. We also have a fancy website now.
For our podcast, it's ltldpodcast.com.
So visit that. You can see all of our episodes, information about each guest with their resources, their websites, some additional resources we've put out there. It's a plethora of information.
It is. It's a great resource.
So thanks, Amy. We appreciate it. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, listeners. Have a good day.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today. In our show notes, you can find information about today's talk, as well as links to resources and other episodes. If you have questions about today's talk, have ideas for future episodes, or just want to stay connected, you can contact us through Diagnostic Learning Services on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So, let's keep talking learning disabilities. This podcast is sponsored by eDiagnostic Learning. You can find more information at www.ediagnosticlearning.com.